Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to cleanorigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's cleanorigin.com, code RADIO10.
When I went to Charlotte's Seed 20 competition, this amazing sort of Shark Tank meets TED Talk competition for social ventures, which is brought to you by Social Venture Partners, I ran into this woman named Kim Alexander, who runs a foundation, a nonprofit called Our Daily Bread, diverting young men from a life of violence into the kitchen to bake bread. And I said, this woman has a story. And sure enough, she does. An incredible backstory for Kim Alexander.
Do it one moment at a time. And every moment there is, you fight for the next moment and the next moment. It's not a minute, it's a moment.
This is In Her Words, a podcast from manlisting.com. Featuring one man listening to the stories of real women in their own words. In Her Words, a conversation worth hearing, because every woman deserves to be heard.
Hey there and hi there, and welcome to In Her Words, my podcast. I'm Stuart Watson. This week, occasionally you meet somebody that they come at you with a hug. They just lead with the hug. That's the case with Kim Alexander, and we had a wonderful conversation in the basement of the First Methodist Church, which is a massive, like more than 80,000 square feet in uptown Charlotte. But most of it is used by these outside organizations like Kim's. She runs an amazing program you'll hear about called Our Daily Bread. But first, Kim's life. It's amazing.
Where were you born?
I was born in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Hospital or home?
I was born in a hospital, yeah.
What was the name of it?
Charity Hospital.
Is actually, it still there?
Actually, no. Hurricane Katrina actually wiped it out. Mm-hmm. Yep, but it was one that all the people went to, especially people of color.
Yeah.
And so when it was wiped out, you know, it was almost like a monument. We all felt lost.
For your mother, you're number what of how many?
I'm number 4 of 8.
Wow. Nice big family.
Yeah, it was a nice big family. I remember us sleeping together a lot. So that was the two-bedroom project home. So, yeah.
What was the name of the project?
A Calio Project.
Is it still there?
Again, unfortunately, they renovated it, not in its own structure as it was. Mm-hmm. And the reason I loved it, although I didn't know that it was considered a project with demographics and things like that, I just remember it being fun. Like, we sit on the porch, you know, after school, and we make sure that we took our bath, and then we play tug of war, hide and go seek. And so I didn't see it as a project because we had so much fun as children. And I didn't know much about myself as a baby.
Mm.
I didn't really have any pictures, and so it was always a mystery to me about who I was as a kid. You know, getting to the family dynamics, actually, it was strained on me. I always knew that I had fun with my brothers and sisters running in the street, playing hopscotch and stuff like that. But other than that, there were some, strained situations in my childhood.
What do you mean by strained?
What I meant by strain is that I was always, probably what you're saying, trying to find my place in the family. You know, like, you know, why wasn't I as special as one of my other brothers and sisters? You know, why was I one that they looked to do everything and not to, you know, feel that love that I thought that was missing in my life?
Mm. Which of your siblings are you closest with to this day, over the course of your life?
I would say two of my brothers, the baby brother, Byron, and then the brother that's right under me, Jerry. So I think I'm closest to them.
Yeah. What was it about them? Was it that you were around them more? That you were had to spend more time with them?
I think for my baby brother, he was like one of my biggest cheerleaders. So he looked up to me, like, you know, he made me feel special. Everything I did, it was almost like he saw the accomplishments I made. And so he was always a cheerleader, always encouraged me on throughout my life and still does.
What accomplishments did you make as you were growing up?
Well, first of all, I excelled in school, which was always something my mom did, you know, instill in us. I remember us having the first encyclopedias in the projects, if you will, that I knew of.
What kind of encyclopedia?
The World Encyclopedia.
World Book.
The World Book Encyclopedia. And so we immersed ourselves a lot in the encyclopedia.
So she bought it.
She bought it, which was quite inexpensive during those days. Yeah. And I think for her, it was a way for her, you know, she believed in education. And though she wasn't present in the house because she had to work two jobs, she made sure that we went to school. That's one thing we always did. We missed very little of school.
What was the point, do you think, for her in instilling this idea of education?
I think basically is what she never had, as it is with me. Like, you know, she always saw that void in her life. And so she provided what she didn't have. And I think that came with her hard work. That came with, you know, now I know today the trauma she had and trying to stop that trauma with us. And I didn't learn that till later in life. But
what was her trauma? There were probably multiple ones, but what would you say were the main wounds that she had from growing up the way she did?
She was molested by her dad, and then later I was molested by him. I didn't find that out till she was 84 years old. And I think the physical abuse that she had, and alcoholism, and my dad beating on her. So that was some of the main trauma that she had.
Yeah. Not to mention, I don't care where you are, certainly in the U.S., if you're a black woman, it carries its own particular path.
Yeah, it does.
How old were you before you realized, like, my brothers or the white girls don't have the challenges that I do?
I was fortunate in that way. I mean, I knew that I came from a different way of life. I excelled in school, and some of my best friends were white. I can tell you an amazing story. I didn't know that I was black in the sense of being black in school, because I was around people that excelled. So that gave me a lot of pride. Sharon, one of my friends, Sharon, her dad picked me up. We went on his airplane that landed in the water in Alabama, and we went to a restaurant. And it was so uncomfortable for them because people treated me different. And so they left there and they took me to another restaurant. And so to this day, you know, I really look up to her and her family for really embracing me as a black girl because I felt normal. Mm-hmm. It was amazing.
Were you scared flying in that plane?
Of course I was. I was afraid to be in a limousine. I didn't know what that was. So it's like in this big car, it's like I'm looking around like, you know. And yeah, later on, I just realized the beauty of it all, you know, and how special I was and how they selected me. Or I was her best friend and they treated me no different.
What part of school appealed to you the most that you were like, this is fun? I like this.
I think getting involved with sports, you know, and being a cheerleader. But most importantly, I love school. So I love taking French. You know, I wanted to, like, learn the world and different languages. I love math, ironically, though it was challenging. And, yeah, I love studying. I still, to this day, love education.
Mm-hmm. Was your father in the home?
Yes, sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes.
What kind of work did he do?
He was a garbage man, as we called it then. Today they call it a maintenance or whatever.
Sanitation.
Yeah, but he was a garbage man.
Did he work for the city?
Yes.
So did he have any kind of benefits as a result of that?
I realize now he did, but not in that. I realized he was in the Army. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons he left the Army is because he had a gunshot wound and they wanted to amputate his leg. Mm. And so for him, that was very scary. And then so he got discharged, and so he has benefits from that. Now, he had a few retirement benefits from the city as well.
Did they amputate his leg?
No. And ironically, after that, he refused to go to the hospital, even in his later years. He was so afraid of going to the hospital because he thought he would die.
How did he get the gunshot? Was it an action or was it?
I don't know.
You never heard the story?
I never heard the story.
Yeah. Did he walk with a limp?
Yes, he did. He did walk with a limp. But I didn't realize that that's why he didn't, he didn't go to the hospital. I didn't realize that that's why he didn't want to go to the hospital until later on in my life. And he said, I'm never going because they wanted to cut my leg off.
Did he serve in World War II?
No, he didn't.
It was afterward?
It was after World War II.
Where was he stationed? Do you know?
No.
Do you know if he got the same benefits that white soldiers got during his era?
Oh, absolutely not. And I think for a lot of black, men and young boys, they didn't. Till later on. I mean, very later on. Mm-hmm. A lot later, I should say.
I gather he's passed?
Yes, he passed about 3 years ago.
At his funeral, did they mention his military service?
Yes, they did honor him during that. Absolutely. We made sure of that. So, we did receive a flag, and they did acknowledge him, which was pretty special, especially for my brothers. Mm-hmm. One of my brothers, he served also in the reserve, mm-hmm. and so we did present the flag to him, and that meant the world to him because they were estranged. A lot of my, and I should interject with that, my dad raped me. So again, there was some, in my life, there was always this space in my life that I didn't know who I was. I excelled at school. I trained for the Olympics. Everything I did, I wanted to make myself special so they can love me. But it was always this haunting stuff in my life, trying to realize why my family treated me the way they did without realizing that either they did something to me or it happened to them as well.
Sexual assault is a particularly awful trauma. What was helpful to you in trying to heal from that?
Finding purpose in life. It took many years. So I suffered from a lot of course, depression. Like I said, a lot of overachievement, even though people, I don't know how people feel about that, but to help with my trauma. But I also did drugs because I didn't want to live. So, I've gone through everything to try what works to heal trauma. And it wasn't until I found purpose in life, that I realized that's what my calling was. And I accepted it as a way of I've gone through all of this for such a time as this. So with Our Daily Bread, I see myself through a mirror when I help kids. All the programs, without me thinking of it, it's my shared experiences truly and how they manifest themselves. And I feel closer to it, and I feel very privileged to be able to share those experiences, but also to get it back as a gift to my healing.
Mm. How did you go about finding your purpose?
Hurricane Katrina. Didn't really realize that that's what the whole thing was about.
Where were you when the storm hit?
I left for Virginia to meet my daughter. She got her first apartment, and that was a week before it hit. I never could go back. And so it was with reading my Bible and just trying to, at that point, still come out of the trauma in a way to find, peace within myself. And it just became really clear what my purpose was, to help young men. The original age was 16 to 24. Now it's 13 to 15. But to help them overcome, the trauma that they have, to create a path of a legacy. Because I saw it as a dying breed, as I still do today. I believe a lot of our young boys are dying, and then that's cutting off the future for other youth that are coming in our, to actually to have a legacy to continue.
Did your mother take you to church when you guys were little?
My grandmother loved and didn't like church. I loved it because, you know, I got to hear it, and I do have like an affinity for gospel and music, but I hate going to church from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m., literally. Literally. But, you know, of course that's ingrained in me, and today I love church. You know, I'm very close to God, and that's my center of my life, yeah.
What church did you go to when you were little?
Triumph Church of God in Christ. Yeah.
What kind of church was it?
It was a Holy Ghost church, as she says.
What does that mean?
It means that, you know, you get the Spirit and you talk in tongues as we know it now, but they, more importantly, they praise God. You know, I can still hear my grandmother, you know, praising God and going to God, you know, throughout my years. You know, she got on her knees. One of my darkest time in my life, I found that my grandmother was always in this little church on her knees praying for me. So, yeah.
You think it made a difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It made a difference. You know, not to kind of interject, but when my grandmother got sick, and I, my goal, or my hope and prayer was that she reach 100. So that was at 98. And so they didn't know what was going to happen. I was here in Charlotte, and I left to go back home. And that had the greatest, one of the greatest impacts on my life, is that she was able to forgive me, and I was able, you know, to forgive her. The fact that my grandfather did something in her day, she couldn't, you know, I felt that she couldn't say anything, you know, so she did. And I was like, you know, she's like, please forgive me. It did happen, because for a long time she denied it. And I think for me, it was always like, please tell me, tell me, tell me. And on her deathbed, she said, can you forgive me? And I said, of course. And she did reach 100. So
it's a real miracle of healing, because plenty of people go to their death not saying those words.
Yeah.
They hold on to it.
Yeah. And in honor of her dying, I always tell people, and they don't get it, but I do, that she died so I can live. Mm-hmm. She died so I can live. And at that point is when I started to embrace who I was and not look for reasons why not, but reason why I was, you know, on this earth to do what I've been called to do.
There's this whole notion now of intergenerational healing, that you don't have to, the DNA is not destiny, and neither is your circumstance. But there's something in the reality of what happened to you that's very, very powerful. Do you have kids?
Yes.
How many?
One.
Wonderful. Son, yes. Or daughter?
It's a daughter.
Why don't you have 8 kids?
I didn't work out that way. I believed in getting married and having a child, or there it's several children. My marriage was a short marriage, not, you know, violent marriage. Is this, I think that we realized that we were two different people. And when I had Ashley, it was a gift. Ashley, when she was born, as early as, I would say, 7 years old, she said she wanted to break the generational curses in our life. I know. Later on, right after high school, she has a tattoo. And around the tattoo, she has a chain that's connected, you know. And then she also has, well, my mom was a nurse, but she also has a needle, which I didn't shoot up. But she had all these things that were parts of the trauma she realized that I had, I guess, and she heard of. And, you know, it's like, that's my purpose, is to break generational trauma.
Amazing. Well, suffice it to say, she was not sexually assaulted by her father or grandfather.
No. But through my fear, when I was, you know, in my drug usage, she was having, like, you know, nightmares, and it may have been, like, something normal, but I sought out a psychiatrist to make sure that that didn't happen. And it hadn't, but it was that important to me, because she was in the house with my mom and my father, you know, and I was like, I just, you know, I felt bad because I know I wasn't there for her. I couldn't be there for her because I wanted to die. But I entrusted in people to be there for her, which happened to me, my family. And in doing that, when I did see her and we, you know, were in the same room or sleeping together, she would just have these nightmares or something. She'd wake up, you know, and I'd hold her. But in my mind, I'm like, I wonder if they did something. So I was always, I guess, in tune with something like that. And I said, I have to get her help. But in doing that, which through a college, and they had a program about child abuse, that they were doing studies. And so I found that, and they tested her, went through this whole series of exercises, I guess as you will, and they said, no, we don't find any of that, so.
What drug did you use?
Cocaine.
How did you shift from wanting to die to wanting to live?
It was manifested in different ways. Like, I ran track.
What was your event?
400 meters. I was invited to the Olympic trials in 1976. My mantra there was run for life. So throughout my life, I just found these different, you know, spaces in my life that I always had something to try to not do it. I went to rehab. You know, I put myself, I went through rehab. I put myself through rehab twice. And I think the disappointment was that they didn't come to support me in family group. But what happened, I just kept trying. I kept trying. You know, I tried this. You know, I knew that education would give me a pathway. I felt that track would give me a pathway till I broke my leg in half and couldn't actually go to the Olympics. So I always feel like, you know, I'm getting there. And that kept me from drugs. But here I come again. I have to try something new. So I always had the hope that I would do it. And then my will to live was just that, Kim, you have to do something yourself. You're looking for other people to help you heal, but you have to want to live. And so I found that time in my life that I want to live. And that's when it started.
What role did your faith or your spiritual life play in that?
Always. I can tell you some, you know, still to this day, I found some writings where I was just crying out to God, please help me. You know, the Lord is my, you know, my salvation. You know, with God, I can do everything. I will, you know, he has me in his loving arms. And I was literally doing drugs. And I found this paper when I started working with the kids, and it was this paper. And I took that paper and laminated it. And so I brought it around because I was asking these kids, is there anything in your life that you want to get rid of? Because I told my story before that. And I had a piece of paper on everybody's chair. I said, write down what you want to get rid of in your life. Not talking about trauma or anything else. And every kid did that. Then I had a bowl of water in the middle of the floor. And the paper was disappearing paper. And everybody walked up and got rid of it. So, you know, God has always been the center of my life, whether it through reading my Bible, whether it's, you know, song. I mean, still today I pray and I meditate every day. God is everything to me.
What does prayer sound like for you? I gather you say words. So what do you say are these prayers of, you say you love praise, I get that, and thanksgiving, but I'm most curious about prayers of petition, where you're asking for something. So what is it that you ask for?
I ask for God to lead me and guide me, you know, so that I could be the best servant I've been called to do. I ask to be closer to God, you know, so I can hear his voice. Recently, I've allowed time and space just to be one with God, and that's in the morning. There's a book called Jesus Calling that it was gift to me from one of my friends, and basically it's a book that talks about God being present in your life, and that this day may be challenges, but just know that he's present with you. And that's just one example. And so for me, again, you know, having God to be the center of my life, I try not to make decisions for myself without, you know, not consulting him, but feeling that he's guiding me. And of course, life goes on. I don't ever make, you know, I'm human, you know, but yeah, God has really brought me further and further to feeling more like a human being and not a robot sometimes.
What church do you go to now?
Right now, I do church online. I obviously because of COVID, but it's the Potter's House, T.D. Jakes. Everybody knows T.D. Jakes.
Yeah.
Here's what I say about church. You know, I think every season in your life, there's a different growth in your, you know, in your life spiritually as there are, you know, and it's fed me. Last week, I tried to find a church home because now I think I want to go back in the house, of, you know, of worship. And so, again, it's just that season. I've never been away from God.
Did you ever feel like you were away from God?
Yeah, when I was out there wanting to die, I felt like, you know, why? And I stopped the police. I was like, why, you know, do I have to keep doing this? I know you're here. Save me. You know, and I just, you know, felt that he let me down or I let him down, whatever way it was. But my darkest point was when I wanted to die, that I felt that I was away from God because God would never choose death for me.
What did the cops tell you when you said?
I asked him, how do I get to the rehab? And I literally had cocaine right there. And I was begging for help. They said, if you go here, here, and here, and I got to the rehab. I think of some of my experiences in life are definitely God protected. Because I would do bold things to ask for help. You know, here I am. You know that I'm on drugs. Please help me. You know, I know you see this. I'm asking for help. Yes, I am high. Help me.
And they at least gave you directions.
Or sometimes they didn't believe it. Because I excelled at so many things.
Well, did they ever lock your ass up?
No.
They didn't?
No, I didn't lock. I mean, I had one experience where I wrote a check where, you know, because I worked in corporate America, and you had all... Sometimes you had, when I traveled a lot, you know, at hotels, you know, you could write checks. And so I was writing checks, knew my money was, you know, up. And I guess one time I went to write the check, the police officer came. And so I was in jail for one day. And because I knew that my friends were, you know, loved me so much, that they would come and get me out. And they didn't.
That's how much they loved you.
They love me, I guess, enough to say no. I still tell my girlfriend over 50 years, Arietta, I said, you left me there. You know, I said, I'll never call you if I get in trouble again because you'll leave me there.
And so, what'd she say?
Huh? She said, you're right. I will never come get you. I will never come get you. Yeah. But I'm grateful that I've had a friend. That's one of the amazing things. She was always there for me. For 50 years, we've been friends.
There are so many people who relapse and they don't make it. What can you tell to another person who is right at that jumping off point? It could go either way.
Do it one moment at a time. And every moment there is, you fight for the next moment and the next moment. It's not a minute, it's a moment. It's one moment in time. And I think once you keep fighting for it, you know, it's in you because you know, you don't want to do this. You know, some people do it because they want to self-medicate and whatever the challenges are. But when you find that space and that moment in time, fight for another moment. We all have trauma. Everyone in this world has trauma. It's not by socioeconomic. It's not by you've, you know, been here or there. It's that if we acknowledge that trauma exists, which we are today. You know, in corporate America, they're saying, oh, you know, I have trauma. Everybody has a therapist. We didn't have that luxury growing up as a therapist. We had grandma and grandpa because they, you know, nurtured us. And so that's one thing. But, you know, I think that the language is an educational language versus a real life language. But when you connect with that person, there is something inside of them that connects them to not only humanize it, but to be more open-minded as a human as opposed to, oh, it can't happen to me or I'm in a certain, you know, demographic that I can't tell you it happened to me, or I can't even tell you that I'm a part of what happened to you.
Yeah. I tell people, dead in Eastover looks just like dead on West Boulevard.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's an equal opportunity destroyer.
We've actually helped heal each other.
Amen.
You know, and through that healing, we heal. That's just like now. When I connect to someone, let's say of a different demographic, you know, and I'm open about my own story, I've heard it happened to me too. Hmm. Not all the time, but it happened to me too. Because I think in that moment, either that person is looking for something like that, or, you know, or I'm looking for them to receive it, vice versa. You know, but it has happened, the acknowledgement in those moments. It happened to me too. Mm-hmm. And I love when I hear that.
That identification.
That identification and normalizing that, you know, we are human. And, you know, trauma is trauma. It has no color. It has no, identification in whether, you know, you're white or black. It has nothing to that. And I think inside, you know, what I always say, we all want to love and be loved. That's the healing of trauma. Love ourselves, love others.
And to be part of something.
Absolutely.
Not to be alone. To have people see us, too.
Absolutely. I see you.
And I see you, too.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to CleanOrigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to CleanOrigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's CleanOrigin.com, code RADIO10.
Why did you choose to work with young men, with boys and young men, and not to work with girls and women?
I often ask that, and I don't know if it's because the what happened to me with men, you know, and to maybe, you know, find something that they're more worthy of. It hurts me today that boys and girls don't have that sense of love, right? When I was out there in the street, I would often ask the people, which are young boys, you know, if you could do anything in your life, what would you do? Because I always wanted to help people. And they said, well, I'd love to own my own business. And he said, why are you out here? Because you don't need to be out here. So there was this commonality. So I knew early on that I wanted to lift these young boys up. And I also know that I was also a hero or someone that they wanted to look up to not be in the street. I found that a lot of young men that I bought drugs from, their parents were on drugs, you know? And that was their way of like either getting them out of poverty or feeling like a man, you know, and I wanted to give them other options because I know that they were missing something in life, whether it to be finding a mentor or whether to give them the maternal love that they needed. So, and I wanted to make sure that life went on with black young men and their families. I believe that that generation was that, but if we can help them come out of that darkness to provide them a more positive life, to see that their life is worthy of something, that then that generation, beyond that, would be a greater accomplishment.
Have you ever been attacked?
Yes. I don't know if I need to go into this. Yes. And I feel that even in my personal relationships, there are some times that I feel an attack. You know what I mean? I'm not comfortable with.
But you've been physically attacked.
Physically fight, yeah. This right here is when a young man, a guy threw a bottle
scar
through.
Scar on
he
your
threw
cheek?
A bottle through my, at me and it went through.
Was it someone you were working with?
Someone I was dating.
Have you ever been threatened by the young men you work with?
No. You know, it's a I had three guys that died to gun violence in our program. I have one guy who heard about Elijah, who's a success. I've never
and
been threatened.
He was a carjacker, so yeah. Clearly he was around guns.
Yes. And they had ankle bracelets, which I never knew. You know, it's not who you are when you come into our kitchen. You're loved. I tell people,
because there are knives in a kitchen.
Well, we protect that. And here's the thing. The youth that we work with, a group, yeah, they have advocates that come with their youth. You know, so it's our collective duty to protect not only them, but those around them. So we have that sense of protection. I had a scale missing one time. I mean, funny story, but not funny. And I approached him. I'm like, look, this was for measuring who has it. I'm not going to ask who has it. Just can you put it back? The door is open. And it got back in there. I don't know where they had it. But, you know, it was that level of respect. And I think because I was open about it. But no, I was never attacked. You know, when these kids come in here, they want something. They come back because they want something. And I think that kitchen does that. They can just feel love. They can, you know, be themselves. I had one young man that came in the kitchen and his brother just died. He came the next Saturday and I heard that his brother died. And I'm like, are you okay? He said, I want to be here, but I don't feel like baking. So he was in the back of the room just being there, and that was okay for me. And eventually he said, can I have some dough and I want to bake something? But for me, that's the beauty of it. I don't find any youth that have come in here, you know, they might not like baking, they might have to be there. So not every youth came back, but none of them came with violence.
I was at a rehab one time. It was Vanderbilt University. It was an inpatient, and there was a black woman there, and she said, Bitches and hoes. I'm so tired of bitches and hoes. There's something that's baked in to our culture now. So how do you, in a culture that immerses people, male and female, into these roles, how do we go from that to my sister, my auntie, my friend? How do you?
I can't do it alone.
I know you can't do it alone, but what do you do?
I think, again, I can't do it alone. You know, and what I say about there's so many layers. You know, even with social media and stuff, this is ingrained in them. You know, this is something that's normal to them. So it's almost like a learned behavior that's a part. They'll say it around you right now as though it's a common, you know, word in the dictionary. That's how ingrained it is. We have rules and disciplines in our kitchen and when they come to us. And so I don't think I've ever said don't curse or anything like that. Because I've never heard bitches and hoes. You know, I've heard other bad language. We don't do that in here. I don't see that that's possible, in all honesty, that one person can do just that. There's a whole lost generation out there. You know, part of that language is exactly what you said. There's no respect for women. You know, there's no identity for women or men. Yeah, there's no love for each other. They don't love themselves. And all we can do is when they're in our presence is to train them up, to nurture them, to give them time and care, as I mentioned. And hopefully that they keep coming back or looking for similar things that can make them feel the same way they felt when they were in our company. But we can't do it alone. It is so beyond what one person can do. It is beyond that. I think that, you know, we all need to recognize that, but there's AI now. There's just so many different levels. If I can have a magic wand, I'd do it. But it's not that simple.
Where did you first see the light come on? Like, you saw, like, an epiphany or a, like a sudden, an aha, where someone was like, oh, I could own a bakery. Oh, I could, oh, I don't have to be, you know, ripping and running. I could be something just like completely different.
There are a couple of times. There are occasions, like I said, when we have other community members that come in and they just have conversations. And one conversation was with a young lady from Arts and Science Council who took interest in one of our youth, Malachi, that he talked about how horses helped him. She's like, wow, I have this old other world that you seem to be connected to. I'd like to help you, you know, find out more about it. And they connected. There was a moment when the kids were baking. This is one of my favorite because it's still going on, where the kids were selling everything. They always get to take something home, which that's our intention. You know, you make something, you can be proud of it. And you want to share it. And then we'll also make something you want to make yourself one day. And so they kept selling the honey buns and they kept selling the, you know, everything we baked. I'm like, why are you guys selling it? You know how much money we made off of that? We have to make the dough. So I woke up in the middle of the night and I say, it's all about the dough. So the kids and I helped form that company, which is now a company that's going to be run and operated by them, that Elijah now see the fruits of what he went through. And he's going to be one of our first entrepreneurs. That was an aha moment. That was taking something and listening to their language, connecting with them, and then not letting them down and appreciating them for hearing their own voice and actually manifesting it into something greater than they ever thought. And so it's my duty and our duty to keep that promise up, to keep that alive, that dream, that goal alive. And that's what we're doing here.
I think bread gets a bad name now. And I think what people don't realize is you can make gluten-free bread. You can make Ezekiel bread. You can get your grains in this very dense slice. It doesn't have to be cake. It doesn't have to be donuts or cookies. You can get all the grains you need in this very dense bread. You lit up when I said that.
Because that's why it's about the bread. It's about abundance. It's about the word of God. But most of all, it's about celebrating you and your culture. We only make culture breads. We do gluten-free bread.
What is a culture bread?
Why?
It's
challah. It's pita. It's naan.
Ah.
You know, it could be French bread. It's, you know, what celebrates you and your culture. In every culture.
White bread and mayonnaise.
But there you go. We literally ate that for lunch. So you've been to New Orleans. You probably had a seat at my table. That's exactly what it's about. So, yeah. So, you know, and that was one of the clear visions I got from God, that it's about the bread, you know. And so bread unites us, love sustains us, right? And so that's just one of the many taglines that's attached. But to see someone come in here and talk about not only their culture, which is how the kids are immersed in that, because there's always a story about where it came from, but it kind of expands their world, you know, just through bread, that they, you can almost picture, you know, that culture, that someone in that, you know, world baking their bread and then translating it to the kitchen and how it's, is done again. But that's one of the greatest things about our daily bread that I love, just seeing different cultures in the kitchen, you know, baking and celebrating their own culture as you know, and at the same time teaching our youth the art, science, and the history of making bread.
What's one thing I was trying to explain to somebody the other day? I said, the only difference in soul food and home cooking is, in home cooking, people are white. And in soul food, people are black.
We all have soul food.
I said it's fried chicken.
It's definitely more than fried chicken because if you take the spices from around the world, we all are intertwined. And I think that that's how it's defined, how you're saying it. But we all have a soul. We all have a spirit. And I think if we allow that to come through, you know, and it happens in the kitchen, then we all, you know, feel the same way.
And so black fried chicken and white fried chicken, you can't tell the difference.
No. You know, Popeyes was made by two, black and white. You know, and oftentimes blackened fish, as it was for Paul Prudhomme, who was a chef in New Orleans. There was a cook in his kitchen that burned the fish. It was burning. And all the spices stuck to it. And there you have blackened fish.
That's beautiful.
I love food. I love celebrating cultures through food. I've never been in a different culture or that they didn't welcome you at their table. They want you at their table because it's a gift of love, forgiveness, you know, celebrating birth. I miss that we used to have in our community in the newspaper when someone had a baby. I hate bad news. Give me some good news. You know, and I think that start with birth, that, you know, we do the weddings and everything's on internet, but it was something about reading it in a paper, you know, and celebrating that no matter what culture you are.
Mm. Yeah. Are all the young men in your program black?
No, we have the Hispanic too. Our main demographics or black and brown youth.
Are there any white kids?
We've had some come as guests, but that's not our main focus. But our community classes embrace all cultures, and we've had all cultures in community classes. Again, there are several reasons. We know that in the communities we serve, there's a lot of trauma, crime is up. They have a lack of fathers. Mothers are not as present, whether it's writing, you know, working to more jobs, whether it's, you know, their own trauma, whether it is that they're on drugs, whatever the case may be. Our kids can't read beyond a fourth grade level reality. So when they're also the man of the house, there's so many things that we try to fill, and the percentage of white youth versus the black youth we serve, they don't get the same, they don't have the same voids in their life, if you will. So we only work with 12 youth at a time in our primary program because we know it's a hands-on approach. We want our youth to be exposed to more than they've been accustomed to, you know, whether it's theater, whether it's art, whether it's big. We don't, you know, when people think about trauma and we say we're trauma informed, we have a whole nother part that kind of feeds into healing trauma. And we do it through the arts. We do it through Blumenthal. We take them to plays. They've never seen that. We might take them to a dinner. They don't know how to use a fork. We have a photography program that's going to be during the summer that Greg Simpson's going to do. I mean, we have chefs that have over 60 years experience. Our kids will never be able to afford that experience. And so we give them a world that they probably have never seen or will see unless they're immersed in programs like ours. We're not the only, you know, program, but what we do is different. And my hope is that they feel that they can excel, because not every kitchen they get in, that they can excel. They just stay the dishwasher. Our goal is to, you know, get them on a path of entrepreneurship. I worked in the kitchen myself. I worked for the Brennans. And I was fortunate enough, because I had talents, you know, to move up the line. But, you know.
What was your job there?
I was a line cook. You know, so I did everything from making salad dressings. I was on the salad station. I was on the hot app station. I was on the grill station. So I was able in that way to learn and to move forward. I had a love for cooking. I had a love for learning. So, you know, I always wanted to know more. And so I think, you know, but we had talented cooks in there that just by cooking, because they did it at home for 8 kids. You know, I have a friend of mine now that you put him in the kitchen. I'm like, why aren't you doing this? You know, it's just the love of cooking and being able to understand the different culture that we live in, specifically New Orleans, the Cajun, the Creole, you have the Spanish, you have the French. You know, it's just a migration just as New York is, right? And so I've been blown away by cooks, you know. But the goal is, and I tell people this, like, yeah, we can train them. They can get their certification. I don't want them to just get stuck there. If there's a pathway to elevate and to own your own kitchen because of your talent, don't stay the dishwasher. You know, well, if you're the dishwasher, get a whole team that now you can run that team and train the others to do it with pride.
And nowadays with street food,
yeah.
Nowadays with food trucks.
Yeah.
And there are with ghost kitchens.
Exactly.
And there are places where, okay, you rent this kitchen and then you just do your numbers.
Absolutely.
You know, what's your markup? What's your labor? What are you going to have to do in order to, I mean, you can do pop-ups. You can do all kinds of things.
Everything. Absolutely.
You have to be creative.
Yeah. And you have to be exposed to the opportunity to know that you can do that. You know, that, I mean, the mindset of a lot of our youth is to get a job, not to get a career.
Or to create your own.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, again, that's a learned behavior. You know, I tell people that the impact that you have, you know, I believe if you have impact on 2 kids, you know, if there are 1,000 kids and you have two kids that, you know, that succeed or transform, it's still 2. You know, so I also believe that 2 can multiply. I could take 2 kids that's in their neighborhood and people look up to them and they're doing something positive, then that could lead to 4 and 6 and, you know, so forth. In my opinion, easier than having 1,000 and seeing 2 in that 1,000 that move on but never, like, are in their neighborhood, if you will. Or it's just solely focused on, look, this is your team. We know that they have gangs and friends that they stick together. And so having this opportunity to see it as what we call a learning incubator, be just like them and they become mentors to them. Elijah's going to be one of those youth. Elijah, you know, from what his story is, you know, stealing cars. Now he's enrolled in college. You know, now he has a car and still is selling cars. Now he wants to be an entrepreneur. And we're going to make sure that we help him get there. You know, he's realized, you know, that he can do more. He said the one thing that really turned him around is that he was in court. And it probably was his last, you know, opportunity to get it right because they locked him up to boot camp. He turned around, he saw his grandmother and mom crying profusely. He said, I can't do this anymore. Then he went to boot camp and he finally made his honey bun cake that his grandmother loved so much. He said, Miss Kim, I took it to boot camp with me and everybody loved it. So when he came out, it was something that connected that he wanted to, you know, do this more. And I wrote him, I didn't hear from him, but we had other people around him that would want to keep in touch with Elijah. Elijah is one of the only black kids we had that have a passport. He's been to Italy and Europe. I haven't been. And I found that out later. I'm like, are you kidding me? You know, so now I'm kind of encouraging him, like, that's amazing. Look how much you can do and share with other people. That's why your palate is so, you know, great. You know, just taking those things and giving back to him is not just an experience, right, for then, but it's experience for now that will enrich his life forever.
If we got struck by lightning today and the only thing that survived was this little piece of digital audio, what is your legacy?
Ooh, that's a good question. that there's something always there for you. You just have to open your mind to receive it. You know, if you never hear this audio and you hear one thing, I hope it's love.
What does love look like?
Unconditional, and we say that term. Love is walking into the room and you give me a warm embrace, whether it's by your smile or your eyes. Like, I don't even have to talk, but you feel welcome, which is when I showed you around this church. I can walk in that room, and I say that to everyone that comes in this space. Can you feel what it feels like in here? Can you see the faces of hope? You know, and it's in that room. And because I believe it so much, and how I say it, I hope that they get it as I get it.
There could easily be a day in which people have no concept, not only of where the food came from, but of how it was prepared, what it took to make it. There could be food which never involved a human, like a machine planted it, a machine tended it, a machine harvested it, a machine processed it, a machine cooked it, a machine packaged it, and then a machine drops it on your plate, or pumps it on your plate, and then a conveyor belt brings it in front of you, and that there's no human involved in that food. What's lost? Why not have the machines do all of it?
You know, I keep saying love. Everything is lost. You have a legacy that's lost. You have a history that's lost. You have a love that's lost. You have, you know, things that you will never be connected to that's human. You will be lost. You will be lost because it's the machine that now dictates and it becomes your heartbeat. Don't ever let a machine take you over because there's just so much to lose. There's so much to lose. Always hold on to whatever memory there is that made you feel good within your family. You know, whether it's a picture. In Hurricane Katrina, we lost everything. There were no pictures. You'll see in tornadoes and hurricanes, people say, wow, I got my memories. Because that might be the only thing that's left. And I've heard it over and over and over again. We don't care about stuff. We don't care. We care about that, like in COVID. People planted. People made bread. You know, that's something nobody wants to lose, the ability to keep that going that connects us. Machine can't connect us. What it does is take away the soul and the spirit. That's never going to happen. We're not going to let it happen, right? We're not going to let it happen.
Not for me. I mean, yeah, exactly. I'm here to collect your voice.
Yeah.
Because a machine can't make your voice. They're telling me now that they could take little snippets of your voice and then recreate you saying whatever the hell the machine wanted you to say. And I'm like, no, because there's only one authentic voice of you.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. And I see a trend of people, if we talk about health, right, that's going back to making sure what they put in themselves is greater than what the machines have done, because we realize it's not healthy for us. Mm-hmm. So in a way, I think that's changing. In a way that I think that people are realizing that they're closer to the seed and the root that's been planted than they are that machine that modifies it or injects different things in it. So let's hope that that trend continues.
Yeah.
That's what I hope.
God bless you.
God bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you more.
I admire what you do.
Thank you so much, Stuart. And I thank you for the time you've taken to hear my story and also to share with the world that it's not what we call success that makes you successful. It's what we've overcome. Mm. And I've overcome a lot.
Yeah, I believe it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Kim has promised me and my wife a baking class. My wife needs no class in baking. I do not know anything about bread other than how to consume it. So whatever we bake, I will consume, I promise you. Kim, I can't wait for the class, and thank you. It's a privilege meeting you.
In Her Words is a production of the Queen City Podcast Network in cooperation with Balto Creative Media. Allison Andrews at Andrews Creative, Rachel Clapp Miller, and Roshonda Pratt are developmental producers. Sally Higgins at Higgins & Owens tries to keep us legal. Our music is A Day at the Park by the group Pictures of the Floating World. Your announcer is Catherine Smith. That's me. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and take a moment to rate and review. It really helps others find us. If you love us, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com. Look for Man Listening, one word, no spaces. A small investment makes a big difference in lifting up the voices of women.
A huge shout out and thank you to everyone who has supported In Her Words, the podcast, manlistening.com, and now Voice Locket, voicelocket.com. Thanks so very much.
Thank you for your support. We believe one voice can change the conversation. Thanks so much.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to CleanOrigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to CleanOrigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for 10% off your purchase. That's CleanOrigin.com, code RADIO10.